All right, I'd like to open our November meeting of the Interpretations Committee. And before we kick off with our first technical part, I just wanted to take the opportunity to introduce a new observer to the Interpretations Committee, Michael Ball, in the corner here, who is here representing the Basel Accounting Experts Group. So he's bringing a prudential supervisory perspective to the meeting. So welcome. And this meeting, we have Young Soo joining us by video link, and hopefully he can hear us and we can see you. So if you put your hand up, we'll know you've come.
I can hear you.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay.
Now, before we start discussing the papers, I guess I just wanted to make a general observation about some of the questions that we've got at the meeting this week. We obviously have a few questions which are related to some of our new standards with an effective date that's really, in reporting terms, just around the corner. So IFRS 15 and IFRS 9. So we're being brave as an organisation and I think as a committee talking about these issues. Hopefully the market appreciates the fact we're talking about these issues, so it's helpful and not disruptive. We're always trying to get the balance right. But I guess we'll help the market more the more that we can give them as much clarity as we possibly can in these discussions rather than reverse. So if I can just ask us all to keep that in mind. Obviously you need to say what you need to say, but I think we all have got I've certainly got an extra sense of feeling of responsibility as we discuss these, given that people are very, very close to the implementation date of these standards. I think we just need to keep that in mind. So no pressure, but just to and I said that before we discussed any issues, so it's not related to anything in particular. All right, so with that long introduction, I'll hand over to Craig, and we'll be discussing paper 2A.
Okay, thanks, Sue. Morning, committee members. So agenda paper 2A is about the application of IFRS 15 to the construction of a building that includes the transfer of land. Specifically, the request asked A, about the identification of performance obligations in the contract, and B, for each performance obligation identified, whether to recognise revenue over time or at a point in time. The main facts of the submission are presented in paragraph 4 of the staff paper. The first part of our paper considers the identification of performance obligations. The submitter asks whether the promise to transfer land to a customer is distinct from the promise to transfer a building on that land. Paragraphs 7 to 24 of our paper discuss the requirements of IFRS 15 in this respect. Specifically, in paragraph 23 of our paper, we have identified a number of factors and questions an entity considers when identifying performance obligations in the fact pattern in the submission. However, in paragraph 24, we note why we have not set out that conclusion in the paper, even though we could do so. So question one for the committee is on page 11 of the paper. We ask whether you agree with our analysis of the factors and questions the entity considers when applying paragraphs 27 to 29 of IFRS 15 to the fact pattern described in the submission.
Okay, maybe before I hand over to the committee, I'll just chip in just for a moment again. So I think what has been said in paragraph 24 of the paper is important, because one of the things we're trying to carefully balance, particularly in all of these IFRS 15 questions, is providing enough information to the market to be helpful, but not getting into a situation where people are almost sending us their contracts and asking us to bless the accounting. So we're treading a little bit of a fine line. So as Craig said, I think the staff could have reached a conclusion and probably could tell what that conclusion might be based on the analysis. But they've chosen not to do so very consciously because we think that it may be better, or the staff think it may be better, to encourage, to walk people through the process they need to go through and the judgments they need to make, rather than being so sort of stuck to the fact pattern and the answer to the question. So that's the approach they've taken, but I think it's one of the aspects of the paper that we'd very much appreciate from the committee about as we discuss it. So with that, I'm opening up to discussing first of all the staff's analysis of the issues. Bob.
Start it off.
I agree with the staff's analysis of whether the questions that you would ask and how you would go through the steps in determining whether you have one or two performance obligations here. Where I am just have a different preference than the staff is my preference would be to not only lay out the things that you would think of, because I think that is very helpful, but I would conclude on whether there are one or two performance obligations here. I think it, as I look, and I'm peeking ahead now to the agenda decision, it seems to me strange to, you go through the analysis, don't answer that, but then answer question paragraph 35 based on if there's two performance obligations. So my preference would be to answer the performance obligation question.
Thank you. Andrew?
Thank you. I also agree with quite a lot of the staff analysis, although not necessarily all of it. I think where I start with this is that I begin by looking at what the promise is in the contract. And in this case, we have a contract where the vendor is agreeing with the customer at inception that the vendor will take this piece of land and construct a building and deliver the finished building on the piece of land. And so that just made me pause a little bit, because one of the other points that I do go back to is that in paragraph 9 of the standard, it does tell us that both parties must be committed to performing their obligations under the contract. And so that says to me that the customer is not saying, I want you to give me some lands and then I'll think about what I do. It is a customer saying, I'm entering into this contract. You'll provide me with a completed building on the land, and that's what I want you to give me. And I think that's quite an important distinction to make. And this then takes me into the question of what is distinct in the context of the contract, because I think that is the key point in this one. And I understand the staff analysis in paragraph 23, because that talks about there being a functional relationship between the land and the buildings, not a transformative one. I'm not quite sure about that. Because if I have a large plot of land, I can use that for various different purposes. I can use it as an open-air car park if it happens to be in a good location. I can use it as a football ground. But once the building's up on it, I can't do either of these. And so it seems that there is some sort of transformation in what you can actually use the land for. So I just pondered a little in that, and I understand that the performance in constructing the building is the same as if the customer had gone and bought the land from someone else and said, come and build a building for me. But in this case, the vendor is selling both the land and the buildings, and the land is unique. It can only be sold by the vendor. The customer can't go and get another one in the same place because there's only one of those bits of land. I looked at the various different examples, and I thought that if we looked at example 11KC, which is one for the supply of the machine and the consumables, I do see a distinction there, because I could, as a customer, quite reasonably, although there might not be much utility, go and buy either the consumables or the bit of equipment quite separately, because there's no interrelationship. Whereas I can't buy the building without the land, because the building's got to have some land to sit on in the first place. And that then took me into the discussion that the board had on the construction of the wall, of the bricks and the subsequent construction services. And I find it very difficult to see a big distinction between that example and the fact pattern that we're looking at here, because what's happening in BC116J is you get the supply of bricks, you get the subsequent construction services, but it's clear that what you're buying is a wall that's already been constructed. So I think that where I get to with this is I think that there are what you've got in this is one overall performance obligation, because I don't think either the land or the buildings is distinct in the context of what's actually been promised to the customer in this contract.
Okay. Bruce.
Thanks. So I'm glad you started with your comment on the dangers, because I also would express I'm very concerned about these examples, and I'll tell you why. I took this and reached out to a number of the property developers that we work with, and my fear was they all started coming back with their own permutations on this and were saying, well, if you don't have the answer, should we send in a letter and ask? And my fear is just on this one alone, we could probably see 3 or 4 new submissions with slight variations. So I think there's a massive danger in it. As far as the analysis, I agreed with the staff analysis. Much to Bob's point, I agreed with that as well, that I felt that we've got to decide what, and I think it comes down to, and the reason I mentioned the beginning part, it comes down to deciding how are we going to address these. Either we're going to say, look, we think IFRS 15 is clear, here's what it says, full stop. Or we're going to go ahead and we're going to do the analysis and finish it. I just think that if we're kind of going to step into that realm of saying, well, on these facts, this is the conclusion, we kind of need to conclude. Because if we don't conclude, then are we saying that the standard's unclear? And I just think we've got to be careful in terms of how we address them. I know you're going to ask later about the agenda decision, but just to point out how I would have addressed this, I'm saying maybe the answer for us is to say, we're going to say IFRS 15 on this, we believe is clear, and give the theory around it. And then lead into providing illustrative examples that the education guys could publish as based on those as non-authoritative. But I'm just very, very worried that we're going to become arbitrators between auditors and their clients, not as much from the auditor side, but from the client side. Every time the client goes, well, I don't like what the auditor says, I'm going to submit something to you if we can get an answer.
And you don't think we encrypt? That's obviously what we've been talking about a lot sort of internally when we've been trying to work out how best to deal with these issues. And I guess we wondered if perhaps by answering the question we were going to encourage that behaviour more.
Well, I think there's a bit of a catch-22, because I think that your opening comments and the comments in the paper around, well, let's try and do this on a timely basis, is opening us up to a situation of saying, well, guys, the IFRIC can get you an answer quite quickly. And my fear is, you know, there's pros and cons to that. The one side is people are applauding us and saying, it's great to see you dealing with urgent issues now. The other side is saying, well, now we can just use you guys to arbitrate every disagreement that we're going to have. And I just think it could turn 2018 into we could have a lot of very long meetings on very specific points unless we draw a line in the sand.
Young Su, I'll let you in, because I have seen your hand, but otherwise you don't know I have. So.
All right. That is fine. That is fine. Andy says something about paragraph 23 of the agenda paper. I have a concern about that too. Actually, paragraph 23 is summarized at page 21, the agenda paper. So if you look at page 21 agenda paper, of the agenda paper, especially the paragraph B, it says, I mean, it gives us some kind of guidelines that we have to follow when we decide the performance obligations. But you know, whenever I read it again and again, I feel like that paragraph can lead us some kind of some unexpected result. So let me give you an example. You know, the best example would be the building materials and labor for constructing a building. So when we construct a building, there could be some building materials and labor, but we know that there is only one performance obligation, which is to build a building. But if we apply that example onto this paragraph, maybe we can conclude that there could be 2 performance obligations, building materials and labor. So what I did is a very simple thing. What I did was to just replace, you know, the plot of land, a block of wood with a building material. So let me read it for you. Would the entity be able to fulfill its promise to transfer building materials even if the customer purchased the construction service from another developer? I think the answer is yes. And the next paragraph, I mean the phrase, would it be able to fulfill its promise to construct the building even if the customer has purchased the building materials from another party? I think the answer is also yes. So the answer is yes for both of these 2 questions. Then in my example of the building block standing and the labor, those 2 things should be defined, identified as a separate performance obligations, which is not what we are talking about in IFRS 15. So, you know, my concern is about this guideline added in, I mean, by the staff in this agenda paper.
Okay, thank you, Yang Su. I'm not sure if that's consistent with how the staff were thinking about it, but I'll let other committee members and others come in first.
Thanks, Sue. I wanted to go back and just ask Bob a question about his comments. Bob, you had kicked off by saying you want to support, you'd prefer if there were a clear expression of a conclusion on the fact pattern, in part to support the follow-on analysis of the two performance obligations, a conclusion. And I wondered what, I just wanted to see whether you thought it was important only if the agenda decision went on to discuss how you would look at two performance obligations, or maybe in contrast with Bruce, who you couldn't have anticipated, you would prefer in any case to always give a conclusion, a specific conclusion in this fact pattern.
So first, I find a little bit of inconsistency. We're willing to answer the question on paragraph 35, but not on whether it's distinct or not. So I'm looking for first for that consistency. Now, my preference would be to be as helpful as possible and answer both. Answer, is it distinct, and are there two performance obligations? Yes, I think yes. I understand there's another view, and then does it meet 35B? Yes. Could I live with, look, we'll lay out, here's what you consider in determining whether there are one or two performance obligations, stop. Here's what you consider whether you meet paragraph 35B or not, stop. Not my preference, but I could live with that. But I was looking, my main point there was I'm looking for the consistency.
That's what I thought it was, and that's what I just wanted to check.
John?
I mean, I agree with the staff analysis on the first question. I think the way that it's been analyzed is how I would analyze it. I think it's how I would read the standard. Similar to Bob, I would have a preference for setting out how you analyze the standard and then saying, and in this fact pattern, this is the conclusion we reach and give an answer. I realize some of the downsides of that, but I think it's left hanging otherwise. So I would actually, I mean, I wouldn't put the submission first and answer the question. I would talk about the analysis and then talk about, given the limited facts we've got, here's how we would apply that analysis to the fact pattern. But I agree with the conclusion. I think here there's two performance obligations, not one.
Thank you, John. Reinhardt?
I also agree with the staff analysis in terms of the performance obligations and land and building each being distinct in the context of the contract. So I would agree with those conclusions. And like John and Bruce and others, I understand the conundrum we're in terms of not perhaps inviting a lot of jurisdictional specific questions, but I do think given where we are relative to the effective date or implementation date for IFRS 15, my personal preference would be to be clear in the conclusion. But I would also point out in the discussion that the conclusion obviously will vary based on the jurisdiction you're in, because we're certainly aware of other jurisdictions where the right to be in a specific place or the land, where that might be a single inseparable strata a unit, and so the conclusion could very well change, and I think it's very important to highlight that. So those are my thoughts.
Thanks, Ron. Gary?
Thank you. And Bruce had said something that's triggered a thought, but he wasn't the only person who got me thinking. I think the standard is very clear what we're supposed to do. I fully support where the staff came out. But I think when you react to that, you need to apply judgment. I mean, the standard is clear. You apply judgment. I mean, now what judgment you choose to apply is something different. I think the thought process, you know, how you make one judgment versus another, I think is very well written here. But the fact there is judgment, reasonable minds, I suppose, could reasonably disagree. But acknowledging what we put here, many of the TRG issues came out exactly like this. We're not going to answer directly your question. We're going to give you the thought process out of meander your way through the standard to draw a conclusion. Though I think it's reasonably clear that this is a two performance obligation answer, I do worry about getting a flood of very tactical questions coming in. I think this is relatively clear, but I can see ones that are a lot less clear to the point of obtuse. I think I just really can't see any other alternative other than what we did is to document out the thought process and how it sort of works its way through 15.
Thanks, Gary. Jim?
I agree with the staff analysis. This is quite obvious by just laying out all the requirements and the fact pattern. Of course, I don't know how often do we see it on a global basis that a developer will give up or deliver the land completely before anything else, and which is somehow rare from where I came from. And usually the developer will put together this whole package without just giving away the land, the title, everything once in advance. But anyhow, given the fact pattern is clear, we should identify two of these obligations. But I do have a concern on the paragraph 24, as Sue mentioned. I think we should give a clear conclusion based on the analysis. Given the complexity of the 15s, it's about to coming, and no doubt there are so many questions out there. We gave them a clear answer so that many others who may have the concerns or questions will see the answer, so that we could eliminate potentially all the futures. If someone, as laid out by the staff, the risk, if they care to ask, meaning they should be significant. And when we do this, of course, I believe in the beginning, the 9 and the 15s may bring us a lot more work to do. But if you do it in a very clear way and educative way so that the market and the professionals should learn and know, so we quiet it down eventually. So I think we should give a clear conclusion on that.
I think very similar to others. I agree with the staff's analysis on the basis of the facts in this submission. I think similar to others, I acknowledge that there could be some differences in circumstances that might lead you to a different answer. So I think we ought to be clear that the analysis is based on the facts in this submission, so that it's not a generic answer that says there is always two performance obligations when you combine the sale of land with construction. I think I share the concerns of some about definitively answering the question, but my sense is that without doing so just seems to me to leave it hanging. And I just wonder if I know the intention is to try and head off the possibility of having 27 similar questions submitted for the next meeting. But I also wonder if it introduces ambiguity. So here's an analysis that seems to point quite clearly to one answer, but then we're not definitive about that answer. Does that mean that some people might go away thinking, well, actually, in this fact pattern, there is another possible answer? So I think on balance, I would prefer that we were specific in saying this is what we think the answer is in this situation, but then we're also very clear that the answer is on the basis of the facts in this submission. And I do understand the risk that we'll get 27 further questions, but...
You have to worry we weren't busy.
Indeed.
Carl.
Hi, thanks. In terms of answering specific fact patterns, in the other hand, I'm in the other end of preference. I think generally these fact patterns are oversimplified, and answering a very simplified fact pattern will create to some specific jurisdictions a lot of additional problems and conflicts between preparers, auditors, and regulators. I have the same concern as Bob said, the consistency of why are we not answering the question related to the performance obligation, but answering the 35B. But I'm, again, in the other hand of the preference, I don't think we should answer neither. And just... A sign of danger.
Special button that I push. Somebody
didn't like the answer.
Yeah, yes.
I wish.
Could use that a long time ago.
Yes, that, and as a concern expressed in the last meeting, I think we are not in the position to be the court of specific fact patterns. And next meeting, there was a prophecy in the last meeting there will be more submissions, and here are the more submissions, and we will see probably more and more if we are going into this path. I'm really concerned about that.
Okay, Bertrand.
So I like most of others, I agree with the staff analysis. I would probably, and maybe we'll rediscuss that later on, but I would have try to, in the tentative agenda decision, maybe better explain the application of 27B and notably the transformative effect within the context of the contract. And I think, Andrew said, I think it's the most important technical issue there, and notably by contracts with the way to consider and to apply 27A, where you consider each performance obligation separately, and then in the 27B you try to assess within the context of the contract the interactions among the various separate performance obligations you might be in a position to identify. But I agree with the staff analysis. At first, I mean, I totally appreciate, and at first, before coming to this meeting, I was in agreement with the proposal not to answer the question, because effectively, each time we will change very slightly the fact pattern, there might be, because, like Gary said, because of the judgment to be applied, there might be a different answer. And I know that some might be fearing that we might be too, or we might turn too prescriptive in the application of this judgment to some specific fact patterns. At the same time, having heard my fellow committee members, I also understand their concerns. Not answering the question might also lead to not suitable or desired outcome. So probably I concur with Tony's proposal. I think it is a way. Either we better explain the way to apply 27B by contrast to 27A, and we do not answer the question, or then like we did in the previous meeting, in the September 2017 meeting for the Brazilian issue, we could also limit really the if we answer, if we were to decide to answer, we could limit that just to the fact pattern described in the submission, and probably do an articulation of the agenda decision the way we did in the September meeting for the Brazilian issue. So either way for me would be fine.
Okay, thank you. Bonnie.
So thank you. I had very similar views to Bob in terms of, at least when I first read through it, thinking that there was some inconsistency with kind of not answering question one, but almost by default answering question one through the analysis in question two. So I've kind of maybe pondered going back and forth as I listened to all of the different comments. I do think, though, that giving an answer in this specific circumstance, I think, is helpful. I think it will be also incredibly important. I liked Gary's suggestion that we remind people that this is judgmental. There will be other lots of other scenarios that may have slightly different facts.
And so that's why it's important to focus on the analysis that the staff did, which I agree with, including, to Bertrand's point, the important point, in fact, I underlined it as I was reading through the agenda decision, is to look at the transformative effect. And so I think that we can strengthen maybe some words within the agenda decision, a very clear reminder that judgment is incredibly important, and that's the whole purpose of principles-based standards, is we have a principle, you have to apply judgment, because every situation can be a little bit different, and you've got to come to the right conclusion. And that's where I think the detailed analysis that the staff did was very helpful to help focus on that. But I do think that we should come to a conclusion.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you, Sue. I'm a little bit with Andrew, specifically with regard to land, and I'm not pretty sure what plot of land really means, whether it is an absolutely segregated individual part of land, or whether it's a piece of land that you probably have partial ownership on. I give you an example. A real estate developer is constructing a building out of 30 apartments, and if someone is acquiring such an apartment, he gets a partial ownership also on the land, and this might be happen already before the building is constructed, and therefore I guess we have to be a little bit more explicit in describing what plot of land mean, or it's just a language thing. That I've had a challenge to understand that. And the second thing is, I mean, I absolutely agree if it is an ordinary real estate developer and a plain vanilla structure, so to say. If it is something very specific, for example, constructing and building an airport where you have the land for, and probably only, and this is also specifically related to permission of authorities and so on, we could end up in a different scenario. So I also welcome a wording that it is specifically depending on the facts and circumstances and doesn't fit for all cases. For an ordinary real estate developer, I would agree on the facts and circumstances and on the conclusion.
If it's helpful, only to say, and I've noted down the point that if we agree, we might need to explain it more, but just to explain if it's helpful in the context of this contract, our understanding is that the customer does get, well, legal title, the land in respect is literally kind of the ground space on which the building will be built. So it's all of that, and there's no kind of joint ownership. It obtains full ownership of that piece of land, whatever word we use, you know, sort of the exact space.
And it's not interdependent to other buildings of the real estate developer and so on. I guess this is.
I think it's a relatively clean case in that sense now. Mikhail was next, but Mary, were you responding specifically?
Yes, obviously very difficult judgment is if we should answer or not. I think it's not a very good future to have these 27 similar questions, and then we produce 4 pages of answers. So I support the staff's first opinion that we should consider carefully to enter into this kind of issue. We have 3 similar questions now already, and we will end up with not principle-based standards, I think, in them. So I support that we should not answer the questions, and then of course do the same with both of the questions.
Okay, thank you. It's helpful. Mary?
Just an observation, thinking about some of the comments we've had about, on the one hand, trying to be helpful, but on the other, concern about what and consequences this would provoke. It seems that there's a very brief window in which, you know, the committee thinks that it can be helpful in terms of the effective date of this standard. And what I'm thinking is whether it might be worth, if the committee decides that it should answer, you know, in more detail, the specific fat pattern, to point out that with the time required for outreach if conducted and for analysis to bring the issue to the committee, that the ability to be helpful in advance of the completion, you know, of the mandatory effective period really runs out very shortly, so that this is a degree of specificity that, you know, they would not expect to be able to bring for much longer, because I think that would maybe condition expectations of the market about the committee's ability to weigh in helpfully rather than with perhaps more harm than good in terms of the approaching mandatory effective date of the standard. And I think that would apply also for the IFRS non ones.
Can I just make a quick comment to that? I'm not entirely convinced, and I'll tell you why. Our experience has been that when you take both the standards coming out, once you get out of the top companies, most of them have really not started much. I think a lot of companies will discover the issues late in the process, which means they're probably not going to get it right in year one, which means I think that by year two, we suddenly have people trying to get it right. So I appreciate, academically, I agree, the time runs out. I think practically, I mean, we're in for a couple of years of this.
I'm not disputing the cycle that people will go through, but I think the question of at what point does it stop being helpful for everybody, including those who have already, who have perhaps reached a quote right conclusions, to continue to have something produced that has more detail. That, you know, that it isn't whether or not issues are going to come in, but it's more about when the committee's, you know, the instincts of some members of the committee to try and be more helpful at this point in time might be balanced a different way if you were 6 months further down the line. It's a degree of specificity. I don't think it'll have any impact on literally the numbers submitted.
The good thing is that I clearly didn't need to give you guys much encouragement to focus on this issue. because I think we're sort of feeling our way a little bit in terms of what's the appropriate approach, and I think we've got a little bit of a timing challenge as well, because the comment period is still open on the issue we discussed in September, so we don't know what the reaction is, not just to the technical analysis but to the approach that we took, which was much more detailed and specific than what we've done in the past. Now, the world might love that or they might hate it, and we don't really know yet, apart from, you know, a few meetings we've been to. And so it's sort of through the exposure process, we'll learn a lot more from people who are receiving this, whether they consider this to be helpful or unhelpful. So I think, you know, we need to form the best view the committee has today, but we do have the benefit of an exposure period to get more feedback to reconsider that when we come back again, assuming we do go with an agenda decision. But I must say, I think we still have a massive perception issue with this committee, and the perception issue is that we don't do things quickly enough, so people don't want to send us questions, and also that if we don't do standard setting, which we're prone not to do very frequently, not inappropriately in my view, but often we don't, that if we do agenda decisions, the perception is we haven't helped with reducing diversity of applications. So I think these style of agenda decisions and trying to do them quickly is addressing a lot of the perception issues that we have, which is, I think, a good thing, but we have to be careful not to go too far the other extreme. So, again, I think we're sort of feeling our way a little bit. Now, Andrew, did you want to come back on technical or process? Because I'm not sure whether John was reacting sort of specifically to what Mary and Bruce were you as well?
I was mainly process with a hint of technical.
So you're hedging your bets there, so I'll let you in.
That's very kind. I'll start with paragraph 24, but because I realised in my enthusiasm I'd missed it. I think at this point in the cycle, we should be trying to be as helpful as we possibly can for people.
What's that mean, though?
I'll come on to what helpful is. The more I see IFRS 15 being applied in anger, the more complex it seems to get, and also the more it becomes clear it depends very much on the precise facts and circumstances. So what I would like to do is, if we do get answered a question, answer that question, but in doing so, be quite clear that we have precise facts and circumstances to deal with. And so you can't take this as being, I think Tony said, you can't take this as being a generic view. You've got to look at your precise circumstances. And maybe I can illustrate that a bit, because Jim said that this particular structure was one that he hadn't seen. I've seen it a few times, and there's a small variation on it. So maybe if I could illustrate that. This one is the one where you have a single contract for the building on the land. What you also see very frequently in the corporate sector is you have a contract for the sale of land, and then there's a 3 or 4 week pause. And then, although there's a very strong expectation that the customer will do so, the customer could get someone else to build the building, but 99.5% of the time the customer comes back and enters into a second contract for the construction of the building. And it's that fine difference in fact patterns that I think that we're seeing out there in practice. So that's why I think we need to be very careful with this. Just on Bruce's comment, I also agree. I don't think this is an implementation year issue. I think there's a very wide range of companies that are going to have a 2, 3, 4 year shakedown period after the first year of application. So I think that we could find that we get a lot of questions. I would rather be as helpful as we can and answer the questions, and then if we find we're getting overrun, then we can take a decision on what we do. But let's see where we go first.
Okay, thanks. John?
Yeah, I just want to comment on the process. I mean, I don't think you can predetermine what we would do. I mean, going back to IFRS 11, we decided that we wanted to take on a number of issues in the year of implementation and issue a fairly extensive agenda decision, and not everybody liked that or agreed with it, but I think it was, in hindsight, very helpful to do that to people in implementing the standards. So I would say I don't see why we would try to determine now when we're going to start taking these. I think we could be very helpful right through the process on certain issues.
I agree. And I certainly don't think we want to sort of set out, you know, the rules now, forecasting forward, but still useful to think about. Jennifer.
Mine was also a comment on process, just listening to the committee discussion. I think also when we looked at it sort of back home, in terms of which questions we're proposing to answer here, it seemed like there was an inconsistency between answering the 35, you know, ABC questions versus the other. But to me, I think kind of like Tony, I wonder if we leave the performance obligation question open, does that create some uncertainty? And so I was just reflecting on all the different comments. Is there enough of a downside to not answer the question? I think it is helpful to give people some direction at this point. But I think Andrew's comments are very important as well in terms of answer the question, but maybe make it very clear that these are, you know, the answer is based on the specific facts and circumstances, and you know there might be different. We know there are different arrangements in different jurisdictions, so don't take it as too broad brush. But that was just. But I think like Mary too, I was also thinking. Does this have a limited window or not? And I appreciate the comments of Bruce and others that perhaps not. But I wonder if we would get, if kind of worry about getting the flood of questions is enough to not answer it. So.
Thank you. Unless the staff want to say something specific on question one, I think we'll go to question two. And then after we've discussed question two, we'll come back on whether we want to answer either or both questions and what we do in terms of decisions.
So in paragraphs 25 to 38 of our paper, we consider the submitter's second question. We first assess the pattern of revenue recognition if the entity identifies separate performance obligations, the transfer of land and the transfer of building on that land. We think that revenue for the transfer of land would be recognised at a point in time. In September, the committee discussed the application of paragraph 35 to a situation where the entity agreed, prior to construction, to transfer a real estate unit to a customer. We have not performed significant analysis of paragraph 35 again. However, in paragraph 35b of our paper, we identify a number of important differences between the fact pattern described in this submission and the fact pattern discussed in September, we think indicate the criterion in paragraph 35b of IFRS 15 is met in the fact pattern in this request. So question 2 on page 17 of the paper asks whether you agree with our analysis of the application of paragraph 35 of IFRS 15 and the fact pattern described in the submission.
only note, Craig, I didn't realise your perfect timing in this paper to talk about paragraph 35A in the paragraph 35A of the paper and to talk about paragraph 35B of IFRS 15 in paragraph 35B of the paper. Sorry.
Sure, that was with intent. Okay, so, opening up for the committee. John?
I agree with the analysis. My only concern is in paragraph 35. In paragraph 35C, when you set out your view about why paragraph 35D is met, I agree with that. But then when you go on to talk about the conclusion, it sort of ignores the transfer of control of the land. So it mentions it in paragraph 35C, paragraph 35B. The custom obtaining legal title to the entire plot of land on which the building is being constructed. But when you go on to talk about in 35C why, in our view, 35B is met, there's no mention of the actual relevance of the transfer of control of the land to the control of the construction. So I think it leaves hanging the relevance of that issue. And the second concern I have is that it seems to then, and this is in the agenda decision, there seems to put a lot of emphasis on the fact the customer can change the design specifications or can actually request changes to the design. And again, I think that could open up some potential interpretive or misinterpretation about the relevance of being able to modify design to the control question. And I know that none of these is determined on its own, but I think we'd better position all of these as being in a collective assessment which gets you there rather than...
Big deal.
Yeah, rather than trying... Because people will try to interpret which is the one that actually triggers the transfer of control, and I think it's potentially not brought out well here that it's an assessment of all of those factors.
Paul?
Thanks. Besides the transfer of the land issue, I think the second important distinction from the September discussion is eventually the housing association interposing between the buyer and the seller. I was thinking how this approach could be a huge structuring opportunity to get a different answer regarding the pattern of revenue recognition. Jumping into very, very specific fact patterns, I think it's a huge risk and not a good path.
Andrew?
Go.
Did you have any reaction to that?
I suppose I'd only say in this case, just to make it clear, the customer in this case, we mentioned up front, is the housing association. So there's no kind of just the housing association slips in as an intermediary between the real estate developer and the end customers. In this case, the housing association is the customer.
But maybe that's Carl's point, that it needs to be clear that they actually are the principal and it's not that they were there for a sort of moment in time or just by convenience.
No, I'm merely edging.
So certainly, we can draw that out.
Andrew.
Thank you. I agree with other comments that you need to look at the overall package of indicators in this place, in this case. I did, however, think that one thing that was persuasive, although it's not determinative, is the customer's ability to tell the developer to do something different, and then the developer can't do something different unless, for example, you can't get planning permission. And I thought that was quite important because it then says that it is the customer who can decide what is done with that asset. Whether it's, so if you're looking at the land, the customer can decide whether more building is to be constructed on it or not, and the vendor can do nothing to counter that unless planning authorities say you're not doing that. So I thought that was quite important. I did agree with the staff that the land control over the land does transfer, and that is important because without the transfer of control of the land, I think it's difficult to get to the answer that we get to, so I would bring that out more as well.
Okay.
Much the same. I agree with the staff's analysis on the basis of this fact pattern. I agree with what John said, that it's the whole package of things that gets us there, and that the transfer of control of the land is an important part of that. And I think it will be important to be clear that it is all of those factors taken together that brings us to the conclusion.
Thank you. Young Sue, were you waving?
Yes.
Oh, yes. I also agree with the staff analysis and conclusion, but I just want to add one thing. One thing I want to add to the agenda decision is the discussion about the applicability of the indicators of paragraph 38. Paragraph 38 explains many indicators about transfer of control. I mean, paragraph 38 of IFR aspect 2. Since it is not discussed in the agenda paper about this paragraph 38 of IFR aspect 2, the analysis seems to be not complete. And if you look at page 15, the paragraph 35C(i), for the discussion of the direct use of the building, it just says about the change in design and specification of the building as it is being constructed, so that it doesn't say anything about the indicators. It just says about, you know, who decides the design and specifications. So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, in the past we said, I mean, maybe that would be more than enough to determine, you know, the customer has the ability to direct the use of the building. But in the past, what we discussed was that the decision can be more educative. So in order for this agenda decision being more educative, I believe that we have to say something about the applicability of indicators of indicators of paragraph 38 of IFR aspect 15 that makes the agenda decision much more clear.
Thank you. And Bob, did you want to come in?
I was going to repeat, I'm in agreement with many of the comments that was already said, that I think I agree with the staff analysis, but we need to build in more into the agenda decision about the transfer of land is important. And
right, thank you. Okay. Marie?
I just have one question around this paragraph 35. Did you think of answering together the question you have on this paragraph 35, which is the one in September and this one, just at the end in the final agenda decision to show the difference in fact pattern so that people can answer together? And maybe in that case it's balanced more, this question of answering very detailed fact pattern, because you will have a different answer, I agree, and you can answer the different fact pattern, but emphasis the fact and second on each one. Maybe yeah. It's a bit premature, but...
Yeah, no, already, because Marie, what you highlight and probably what you see coming through already in the paper and in the agenda decision is we were already trying to work that through and anticipate it slightly, but we haven't quite got there. And I think that, well, we haven't quite got there because I suppose we don't know yet, you know, subject to comment letters, where we end up on the first one. But it's right that we were already cognizant of not just producing two separate agenda decisions that might end up, you know, repeating and saying the same things are being cloudy. And actually, I mean, we see where the committee ends up on this, but if the committee, you know, agrees with our thoughts on this, and again, assuming all kinds of things about this, you know, where we are in September, at least tentatively, if there was a way you could use maybe the two different fact patterns as contrast, so still hopefully use the same words if we've done it properly, about more the general thinking about how you go about applying paragraph 35, and in particular paragraph 35B, and then the two specific fact patterns would show some contrast, because I think, you know, we would think there are quite fundamental and significant differences between the fact pattern we discussed in September and the one we're discussing here, particularly obviously in the context of 35B, and those two different fact patterns conclusions could possibly be used to show the contrast and hopefully provide a bit more flavour then about how you go about applying the requirements.
I think we certainly have to be aware of the interactions between this one and the next one, actually, and the one in September. And I think maybe at one point a question we need to think about as staff and as a committee is whether it's
more important to finalise the September decision as quickly as we can, potentially at the January meeting, depending on what the letters are that come in, or whether it makes more sense to hold that and wait for the feedback on this and sort of look at them slightly more holistically, which might help with this piecemeal sort of thing we're getting into. But I think that depends on how important we think it is to give clarity on the September issue in part. But I think at a minimum we need to try and think about how, when we wrap them all up, there's clarity about what's similar and different between the package. Now, what I was planning to do next would be to ask the committee to see whether you agree with the staff recommendation not to add this matter to the standard setting agenda, and then following that to then talk about what we would do, assuming you say you agree with that recommendation, that we talk about the tentative agenda decision, and when we do that we can talk about whether or not we actually answer question one and question two or neither. So if that's all right, I'm going to do it in that order. So the first thing I ask the committee for a show of hands on is whether you agree with the staff's recommendation not to add this matter to your standard setting agenda.
That is everyone?
Everybody.
Okay, so that's everybody. Thank you. Now the less simple. So that means that we've moved to looking at the tentative agenda decision. And Katrina, do you want to run us through this? I guess the first question is whether we want to answer question one. So can I, Angelo, ask whether the answer is two?
Yes.
And whether you think that the answer is in accordance with the staff's analysis that there would be two performance obligations in these facts and circumstances, and we'll come to that, making that very clear. But firstly, a show of hands on which committee members would prefer that we actually answer question one. I'm making it clear that it's based on the facts and circumstances.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Yep, that's the majority. And I'm assuming that unless anybody says otherwise that we would also stick to answering question two, so we've got consistency between the two. Yes, good. All right, now, Katrina, do you want to go through what you've heard in terms of modifications to wording, and then we'll ask the committee if there's anything we've missed?
Exactly. So I'll tell you what I've noted. So I've noted possibly that phrase, the plot of land. We'll have a look at that and see how well that might be understood, or whether we need a bit more explanation. I've noted down that depending on specific facts and circumstances, and really emphasising that. So again, we'll look at how we do that. So if there's any extra emphasis needed. There was quite a lot of conversation about, you know, judgment obviously based on the facts and circumstances. We do have that word judgment in there already near the top of page 20, but again I can look at whether we think we need more on that.
I heard some calls for building on the 27B analysis and making it clear what this transformative, making more of the transformative effect on the analysis.
Exactly. So again, that transformative relationship is mentioned a few times, but we can have a look at people's specific suggestions on anything extra on that. And if I move further then through to the application of paragraph 35 in particular, we have mentioning that transfer of control of the land as being an important piece of the 35B analysis and reaching the conclusion that we think in this fact pattern in terms of construction of the building, the customer is getting control
of. And also John and maybe others made the point that we should not make such a big deal of any particular factor pushing the analysis, so the control over design I think was the one John used as the example.
I think that might come in, it might come in directly, because if we actually make comment more about the control of the land, that will hopefully make it a bit more balanced. I'll maybe just explain that what I know that Young So talked about thinking that it would be helpful to talk about the indicators in paragraph 38 in the agenda decision, and at least my inclination at this stage is not to do that, but I want to mention it in case so the committee can disagree with me to the extent they wish to. The reason for that is that when I look at the indicators in paragraph 38 and I look at the facts we've got, so some indicators about, you know, physical possession, transferring legal title to the asset, significant rights and rewards, to me those first of all are only indicators. You know, the overall assessment, it's not that you have to by a checklist go through these indicators in order to reach your conclusion. And, you know, this is all about assessing control. So I suppose what we've done at the minute is just directly assess control. And given the facts, to me, it would potentially cloud the analysis to start to go through the indicators, because I don't think there may be particularly relevant or helpful to this fact pattern.
Okay. Bonnie?
So I just wonder if either at the beginning or the end of the tentative agenda decision we remind everyone that while our intent is not to answer specific questions, we're providing conclusions given the time-sensitive nature of the implementation, and to remind people to make sure that they focus on their specific facts and circumstances and apply judgment in applying the principles that are discussed. This is a very clear reminder of what our intent is by concluding, but also to try to balance, you know, may not solve Bruce's challenge, but or what the challenges that we're expecting, but I think just adding that specifically may just help remind people what the real purpose of the documentation is.
And I think if we said that we think the committee thought it was particularly important given the timing, then it doesn't sort of box us in later if we decide we want to do something different, but at least then people can react to whether they thought that was appropriate or not as well, which would be another useful piece of information. So with the Young Su?
Yeah, the as for paragraph 38, I understand that paragraph 38 is not mandatory to be reviewed for you know, judging the transferability of the asset. But what I'm trying to say is that when I looked at this paragraph 38, the five indicators are not, I mean, none of these five indicators are satisfied in this specific context. So, you know, if we say the indicators of paragraph 38, none of them are satisfied, but if there's some other indicators that can satisfy the transfer of the asset, especially the control of the asset, you know, we can say the asset can be, you know, the we can recognize any revenues for the asset. So what I'm trying to say is that even though any indicators paragraph 38 is not satisfied, if there is any other specific indicators that enable us to recognize revenue, we can do that. I think that can be written in the agenda decision. I think that is kind of an educative agenda decision that we have to issue.
Okay, thank you, Young Su. Katrina's scribbling. All right, so if there's no other comments, we'll move forward on that basis with that tentative agenda decision. Good discussion, and thank you for answering the question I wanted us to focus on. With that, we'll stay on the subject of IFRS 15, and Craig will take us through agenda paper 2B.
So agenda paper 2B deals with a second question the committee has received for the application of paragraph 35 of IFRS 15 to the real estate sector. Specifically, the request asks whether, in a particular fact pattern, an entity has an enforceable right to payment under a contract and therefore meets the requirements of paragraph 35C to recognise revenue over time. The main facts of the submission are presented in paragraph 4 of the staff paper. We have considered whether the entity has an enforceable right to payment in a fact pattern described in the submission in paragraphs 14 to 31 of our paper. In particular, we have considered A, the objective underlying paragraph 35C, B, the customer's rights and obligations on cancellation, and C, the contrast with the circumstances described in paragraph B11 of IFRS 15. As noted in paragraph 32 of the paper, in our view, in the fact pattern described in the submission, the entity does not have an enforceable right to payment, and thus the criteria in paragraph 35C of IFRS 15 is not met. On page 10 of the paper, in our first question for the committee, we ask whether you agree with our analysis on the application of paragraph 35C to the fact pattern described in the submission.
Okay, who wants to go first? Reinhardt?
I agree with the staff analysis in these particular facts and circumstances. And I think it's really important that based on the facts, that although the customer has the obligation to pay, that the entity itself is required to market the unit to a third party, and then ultimately the customer is only responsible for the loss. And so I see the clear distinction between transfer control and compensation for loss. And so I think the staff paper, I would agree with the conclusions in the staff paper in that respect. And so I think that in my mind is the key issue, is that in essence the customer is only responsible for compensating for the loss. And the way I read IFRS 15, you look to the original customer, and here the real estate developer's right to get compensated is through not necessarily the original customer, it's the original customer plus somebody else.
Okay, thank you. Bob.
I agree with the staff analysis. I think the staff brought out in the paper fairly well. 35C is not a practical expedient. It's not an offshoot. It is part of paragraph 31, the control notion. It explains how you apply a control notion in a different fact pattern. And so in 31, it's very important that, or one of the criteria is that the vendor has transferred control to the customer. Now, in this situation, under 35C, the only way to evidence that, or the most important way to evidence that, is that the customer is obligated for the entire payment or for performance to date, not just the loss. So that was what was convincing to me in the staff's analysis. I think that could be brought out a little bit more, peeking ahead into the agenda decision. In the agenda decision, in that paragraph that's underneath A, B, and C.
Thank you, Marshall.
In general, I agree with the staff. However, I guess we have to be sure that we are really talking about revenue. And if that would be an exception and unique, so to say, in that contract, and in general the company or the entity does not have similar contracts, then for me the question is, what is the compensation payment? Is it really ending up in the revenue line, so in the top line, or is it somewhere depending somewhere else? So in general, if that is a typical pattern, absolutely agreed. If it is a unique exception, and this is not, I guess it's not clear out of the fact pattern. I assume it's a general pattern that should be made clear. Otherwise, one could come to another conclusion.
Tony?
I agree with the staff's analysis. I think the principle behind 35C and the way that's explained in the basis makes it clear that control transfers when the customer has an obligation to pay for the work as it is being carried out. And I don't think the potential entitlement to be paid by somebody else under another contract should be included in that analysis. I can't see there's any basis in IFRS 15 to combine those two contracts. And therefore being paid by another party doesn't help me get to the criteria in 35C. So I agree with the staff's analysis and the way that's been explained in the agenda decision.
John?
I agree with the staff analysis. I think it's helpful to focus on the objective of 35C rather than just the words that are in 35C. I think if you just read the words in 35C, you could argue, you could make a point for loss of compensation versus right for payment for performance completed to date. But I think when you read 35C in the context of this is about the transfer of control, I think that the reading is the right reading, reading the staff paper is the right reading. A couple of things, it does seem to indicate, there's a couple of things which I think are unclear in the paper, where it sort of talks about the right to be, the fact that the customer does not have the right to any upside on the resale of the unit. So it's only downside, but it doesn't go on to elaborate whether that's really important, and if they did have the upside, would you reach a different conclusion? And I know we don't want to get into what ifs, but I think once it's hinted, once it's mentioned, it begs the question. And the other issue is, I mean, what if the developer was actually appointed as the agent on the customer's behalf to sell? Or if the customer did have the upside, could you argue that the developer is actually selling the unit as the agent of the customer, and therefore the control has transferred? None of that is sort of elaborated on in the paper. Now, I know it's not the fact pattern, and we don't really want to start talking about what is, but it does leave the question hanging about the importance of that issue. So.
Yeah, so I agree with the staff analysis, and maybe I would echo John's first comments in saying that effectively the answer is not necessarily spontaneously intuitive, but obviously not that it is counterintuitive neither. I mean, if you apply the principles in paragraph 35C, you get to the answer. So I think it's important to answer it the way it's done.
Carl.
I also agree with staff's analysis, even though my concerns on agenda paper 2A are the same. I will not repeat that. Thank you.
Yang-Su?
Yeah, I also agree with the staff analysis and conclusion. And I think that this agenda decision is very, very helpful, especially, you know, this agenda decision makes two points very clear one more time. The first one is that it makes clear once again that IFRS is a contract basis, and what is important is the contract between the entity and the original customer. And the second point this agenda decision makes clear was that the revenue can be recognized only when a customer obtains control. So for that, I can answer to John's question a little bit. John asked some questions about the upper side, right? Upper limit of the compensation or the benefit. I think that is important also, because when customer has the control, the revenue should be recognized. Customer has a control means that customer must be able to obtain substantially all of the benefit from the contract. So when there is an upper, you know, upper side of benefit, it should be obtained by the customer. So I think that is also important for this decision. So, you know, I agree fully with the staff analysis and conclusion.
Okay, thank you. In which case, can I ask the committee for a show of hands on whether you agree with the staff's recommendation not to add this matter to the standard sitting agenda? Everyone? Yeah. Okay, which means that we go on to talk about the proposed words of the TransDef agenda decision that is set out in the appendix. I don't know, staff, whether you wanted to comment on the point that's been raised by a couple of people about the upside.
I'm not sure I want to comment. What I was going to comment on was that, and what I did want to comment on is I've heard both Bob and John mention that maybe drawing out the objective would be a bit better. So, for example, and I know you highlight so particularly in the paragraph just after the A, B, C in page 13 that we'll maybe draw on something like it's in paragraph 24 in the paper that talks about, you know, the objective to say that, you know, the criteria in paragraph 35 were developed to provide an objective basis on to assess whether the customer actually controls the asset as it's being created. So we're certainly happy to put that message more into the agenda decision.
Okay, Jennifer?
So I had maybe a different suggestion on the wording in the tentative agenda decision. This is more in the second to the last paragraph. It really gets to the issue about, you know, right to compensation for loss versus having right to payment completed to date. I think when we talked about it in our own group, I think we started getting into issues that are dealt with in the agenda paper, but not necessarily in the tentative agenda decision. So, for example, the novation example, which is dealt with in the paper, and also just the situation where maybe the unit is resold, but for a zero price, and so in essence, the customer has to pay the full amount. but that's still not the same as a right to payment to the entity throughout the contract. So I just wonder if maybe some of those could be built into the second to the last paragraph. And maybe, you know, obviously, the staff may look at it and decide if you put too much detail in, there's a risk of, you know, complicating it further. But maybe just to think about that.
Maybe there's two things. And sorry, John, we'll let you talk first, and then you can.
No, I was going to say. I wasn't suggesting that we needed to do a lot of what if. But it's not clear to me if the lack of providing the upside to the customer, or the fact that you have to enter into another contract with another customer is the determining factor here why 35C is not met. I mean, it hints at both of them, but those are very different notions. I mean, if the customer had got the upside, would you believe that the fact that you have to enter into another contract to actually settle to get the amount, you might say that, I mean, it doesn't matter the fact that they get the upside. That's irrelevant to the conclusion.
Yeah, I was just thinking about whether to take that fact out, John.
Because
you say potentially it's a distraction.
It wasn't clear to me the basis. I mean, you could argue that if the notion is transfer of control, then it doesn't matter whether the customer gets the upside on resale. If I have to enter into a contract with another customer in order to get that compensation, it's actually irrelevant.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure whether the staff believed it was irrelevant or not when I read the paper. So
one thing I was going to suggest then, both in response to something Jennifer said and what John said, because it's a good point, John, and we kind of spelled out the facts as we got them all, but of course what is always confusing and not helpful if we include extra facts that are perhaps not determinative in the assessment versus where they are. So at least based on what you said and the thinking is that the way we could deal with that, and at least the way I'm thinking at the minute and others can disagree, is that perhaps we simply take that, the fact that the customer has no rights to upside, we could remove that from the facts in the text of the agenda decision, which would indicate that's not what matters in a sense in getting to the answer, which could take away that question. Also, Jennifer, to your point, the one thing is that we could, for example, in the facts perhaps state clearer that, you know, some of that what we said in the paper, which is when the entity has to go out and find a new third party, that is a completely separate new contract. It's not the original contract being novated. So that might be a way of closing that off to just sort of make the facts just a bit crisper.
Andrew?
Thank you. I'm just thinking back to the discussion in the previous paper where there is, all the concern about getting lots of different questions. And it seems to me in this point of whether the customer is entitled to the upside or not, if that is truly not relevant, because the important part is that the customer has to be the one who pays from the original contract, then I think we should say so. My concern at not doing that is that if we leave it open, then at the next meeting we'll have a question that says, well, what if the customer did have the upside? And so it's a way of heading it off before it comes.
I think if we sufficiently draw out what is the point of principle here, you sort of, I think you've managed that risk, I think. But I think we need to think about it.
Yeah, I think it's like, so what we're suggesting doing, Andrew, and maybe you can see whether you think it works, is if we take out that piece of the facts, that makes, so we basically won't make any reference in the facts to the customer having, you know, no access to the upside, but we still, you know, still, and then the conclusion is very much drawing on, you know, the fact that the payment needs to come either from the customer or certainly be on behalf of the customer. It has to be entirely associated with performance under the original contract, not a new contract. Hopefully that combination will make it clear.
People are nodding, so I think that's agreed. So that's all we need on IFRS 15 for the minute, is it? Good. All right, so we're going to break.